Good morning. The House Education Committee will come to order. It's Monday, March 3rd, 2014, and the time is 8:07 a.m. Today we'll have presentations in regards to charter schools from charter schools. We'll have a presentation from Les Morse with the Department of Education, Barbara Gerard from the Academy Charter School, and Joey Eske, Aquarian Charter School. With that, we have Representative Seaton, Representative Keto, myself, Representative Lynn Gaddis, Vice Chair Reinbold, and Representative Peggy Wilson with us today. We'll start out with inviting the department forward, and if they'll introduce themselves for the record. And before we get started, I will make mention for the record that our intention is to move this bill here in the next couple of weeks. So with that, we'll put on the record that we may end up recessing, not today, but utilizing and going into night meetings if that's what it takes. So the committee is aware, with the exception of possibly Representative Wilson. I didn't get to whisper to her before I put it on the record. But I want to remind the committee members that we're going to really be focusing on this bill so that we can get it out in the next couple of weeks. With that, we'll have the department put themselves on the record, and we'll get moving. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gaddis. For the record, Les Morse. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Education Early Development. I'm going to give a little background on charter schools, the law, and some issues from the state perspective around how we implement the law. And then I think you have people online who will be able to give you a really good background in terms of what that looks like locally. Just to start off, we have about a little over 6,000 students in charter schools in the state. We have 27 different charter schools in 8 different districts in 13 different communities. The charter school law in Alaska was codified into law in 1995. I'm going to speak to the establishment of charter schools. They're established by a local school board. Then it does come to the state board for approval, but primarily the state board's role is one of approving it if it meets the legal criteria. The local board is supposed to, or is required to, set out a procedure in their policies and procedures that outlines the application so that parents, teachers can see what that application looks like. That application must include an academic policy committee, which does again consist of parents, teachers, and school employees who will work within that school. The local board, once they take an action, either approval or disapproval, must forward the application to the state board. And as I said, then the state board reviews it to make sure it meets the legal requirements and then approves the application. This is a piece of the law where the governor has put forward a proposal in HB 278, and I'll just mention that quickly. Within the Alaska Education Opportunity Act, allowing the department to act, if there is a denial, to act upon that and review that and either remand it back to the school district for further review if it met the local the legal requirements, or take it onto the state board for an appeal process. Next, I want to speak to the organization and operation briefly in terms of how that looks from the state level.
And just a moment, Mr. Morse. We've been joined by Representative Ledoux, and I also have a question for you. Why a charter school? Why do we have charter schools? Why not just neighborhood schools? Why did the state of Alaska in 1995 choose to have charter schools? And I guess there lies, for the public's reference as well, what the difference between a charter school is and a neighborhood school. And if you have that part of your presentation later on, I'll let you continue.
Representative Gaddis, or Chair Gaddis, it's actually perfect timing. That's really the next piece when you get to looking at the organization and operation, which is laid out in law. It begins to lay out why we have these schools. I'd start out by just saying broadly, innovation, opportunity for families and teachers to really do something different than might be allowed in a neighborhood school. But let's look at exactly what the law allows. First off, the charter schools exist within a school district, and that's important. They are public schools. They exist within the school district that they are in. So there is a charter school just down the street. You've probably heard about that. That is part of the Juneau School District. But what makes them different? Well, the local education agency, which is the school district, they're exempt from having to use the textbooks, the instructional program, the curriculum, and any scheduling requirements that school district has in place for all their neighborhood schools. Any other policies and procedures, let's say the local school district has their own testing program, they may choose to exempt that charter school from that if the charter school requests that. But they are absolutely exempt from the textbooks, program, curriculum, and scheduling requirements. Additional exemptions would be laid out in the contract between the charter and the local school board.
Just a moment. Mm-hmm. Representative Ledoux.
I'm just thinking, if a neighborhood school, you know, if the principals and the teachers thought, you know, these textbooks don't really seem to grab our students. There's these other textbooks out there that we think would be better and more appropriate for our student body. Is there anything within the neighborhood school system that lets a neighborhood school opt out and choose a different text? And if not, why not?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that really depends on the school district. I've worked in two different school districts, one that was spread out in lots of different villages, and at the time, but this is a long time ago, they did allow some local choice around that because the students in the community I was in, which was one of 11 communities, generally stayed in that community, finished their schooling. However, my more recent experience was in a neighborhood school where there was another neighborhood school across the town that was students would move back and forth. So the district made the decision in terms of what is going to be the curriculum so that there's consistency and efficiency in terms of training people regarding that. So it really is an individual school decision if the district makes it that way, but it's becoming less and less so simply because there are efficiencies in adopting the same program in terms of the staff development and training and the work that goes around the purchasing of that. So it really does end up being a district-by-district decision there. Should I go on?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure from my perspective that you answered the question. And I guess the real question is, if neighborhood schools can do the same thing that charter schools can do, then why have a charter school? It gets to a bigger question, but still, to put it out there, if you will, what the difference really is to between a charter school and a neighborhood school.
Chair Gaddis, in reality, I don't think neighborhood schools can do everything that a neighborhood or school within the district that's a neighborhood school can do or can't do.
Try it again. You bet.
Let me just go like this. Charter schools have the opportunity to choose a different, completely different instructional program. Generally, in a school district, and this is more so than not and probably almost universal at this point, the district adopts a curriculum. The district adopts the textbooks. The district adopts the instructional program. That's all decided at the district level. Teachers from all the schools typically participate in that process, but at the end of the day, the district local board adopts all those, and that's what they use generally for the next 6 years at least. And the school doesn't have the choice to opt out of that. That is what they're required to implement. That's what the principal who works in the school is required to make sure the teachers are implementing. So the charter allows for those groups that do that the opportunity to innovate in a different way than what is happening within that community in all the other schools.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How is this working with the new innovation, especially the one-on-one technology, the District 6 iPad, where all of the schools got iPads, and part of the philosophy behind that was a teacher could change textbooks for the entire classroom for about $15 with the educational discount for class of 30. And that was one of the provisions that was looked at as a real benefit, because if the algebra one textbook and the kids weren't getting it, they could switch to a different sort of a different curriculum, a different textbook program for $15 instead of every time you change textbooks, it's $100,000 in a district. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, has the department seen any usage of technology, or is it just we're stuck with the same textbook and technology is just a little add-on thing in Alaska that we're not going to be expanding the usage of that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think we do see the use of technology, but I think it's regardless of whether it's a charter school or a neighborhood school. The benefit in the charter school, obviously, is you can make those shifts and adjustments by just working with the parent advisory or the policy advisory committee or the academic advisory committee, excuse me, whereas the district moves the entire system when they make that shift. Those costs are go on to be a savings, whether it be the charter school or the district as a whole. But the technology is being used in either case. I think of the technology more as a tool, like the pencil or the textbook or those kinds of things that we do more efficiently when we had to depend on a hard copy textbook in the classroom.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Well, the idea of the technology, mobile devices being just a tool to present the same textbook that was adopted by the entire district is not at all what the legislature was looking at when we, you know, funded and when we have put one-to-one technology into the school district. So if you're telling me that the way it's being used across Alaska is simply an electronic textbook instead of alternative education that will more closely suit the students in particular classes, I'm kind of disturbed. So would you expand on that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you were asking about textbooks, so my response was about textbooks. But that certainly isn't the only use that that technology has. I was only speaking to the question that you asked. I see the technology as allowing a much broader allowance of what can happen instructionally, to do things in ways that you otherwise couldn't do with a textbook or without technology, to reach out and research in different ways. I was only addressing the textbook issue because that's specifically what you asked about, but I don't know if this is the time to have a broad discussion on the one-to-one and those kinds of things.
Right, as I indicated, we're going to have night meetings if we go down these trails that don't have to do with the bill. And as much as I appreciate, and I personally appreciate technology, and I really think that's where Alaska is going to make its greatest gains when we embrace technology. And I have said that many times. But since it's not part of this bill, if we could hold it off till after we get this bill out, please, I'll ask that we mark down technology as one of the discussions that we have after we do. I think it's a good conversation. Representative Seaton.
And Madam Chair, I wasn't trying to go down to technology. I was trying to go down the difference between charter schools and local schools, neighborhood schools, because one of the interesting things we're being told that neighborhood schools have to be lockstep, and yet the institution of one-on-one technology was to make it so that the local schools wouldn't have to be lockstepped. And so I'm trying to figure out, that was my question. It wasn't just talking about technology.
And I understand that. And I think, and I'm going to say what I think I heard said, was that the school board sets the curriculum typically for the neighborhood schools. lockstep. I suspect that that's one of that could be said. Charter schools can, they're smaller. They've got an individual board that directs that individual school, and I do believe that they can pivot faster rather than having all of the schools and waiting for a school board meeting and going through that process. So I think that there's a lot more cumbersomeness in the neighborhood schools that the charter schools don't have to deal with. I think that's what, am I speaking to what you were mentioning?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just wanted to, the distinction was made that charter schools are flexible, but there was basically no flexibility in the neighborhood schools, and the technology that we as previous education committees have supported was to give flexibility for doing that and bringing in other curriculums that work better with those classrooms. So if that's the way it's being applied across the state, that it's the districts aren't being that flexible, I'll just follow up that later. Thanks.
Okay, I understand where you're saying, and I guess in my opinion, it has to do with a whole bunch of schools being governed versus only one, and whether you have a whole bunch of businesses that are being governed under one or just one small business that you have a small business owner, certainly the smaller one can pivot a lot easier, faster, and technology can be a less expensive, and as we all know, it really gets down to what the costs are as well. It's hard to change curriculum, every year if you're buying new textbooks and you don't have the money, as you indicated, if it's a lot easier to buy technology. So I think that that's a conversation, but although I think just by the economies of scale, I think that's where I think that it becomes more cumbersome for bigger school districts, which I think has very little to do with it being a charter school or neighborhood school, and more about just how school boards deal with that.
Chair Gaddis, none of my comments, I don't think, suggest that innovation doesn't happen in our regular neighborhood schools. I spent a number of years myself working in schools a long time ago, and I know more innovation is occurring today. It's just that innovation has to fall within the district's curriculum. So let me be clear about that, because I'm not suggesting that can't be innovative in a neighborhood school. I'm suggesting it has to fall within the context of what the board has outlined as their district's textbook series, program, and curriculum. But there can be very innovative things going on if it's allowed within that. And even within the school, there can be different innovative things happening. So innovation can happen anywhere, but I would agree with the chair. It can pivot differently and probably more easily at these charter schools, and that's one of the benefits.
And if you don't mind, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with this sheet right here. So when you get done talking about the law and whatnot, I'd like to talk about this sheet.
Chair Gaddis, I don't know what sheet and that is. It might have been outside, but it's not provided by me.
And I think this sheet, as Representative Wilson is discussing, is a Anchorage Charter School Facilities Analysis. And I must apologize, I'm not exactly sure where it came from. So before we get into it, we'll find out for sure where it came from and make sure that the department has a copy of it.
Yeah, Chair Gaddis, I'm guessing one of your other speakers may be able to.
Right.
That may be where it's coming from. So you may want to hold till you hear from
me. Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
If I can go on, because I want to make sure you get to your other speakers as well. The one of the other exemptions in law is that the selection of the principal. If the charter school has a principal, the principal is selected by the academic policy committee, which works with that charter. In most schools, the principal is selected by the superintendent. But again, that's not true in charter schools if they have a principal. Again, not all charter schools have principals. A couple of other things, if I can move to the contracts. First off, the way the charter school is laid out in detail at any one of the or at all of the 27 charters across the state is through a contract between the local school board and that charter's academic policy committee. The contract that they have with their district, the charter has with the district, lays out the educational program description. In other words, what it is that their educational program will do. From there, you would learn how it would be different than the neighborhood schools, the level of achievement they would expect, their admission policies, all of their admin procedures. It also lays out the budget allocation and any costs assigned to the charter school program budget, or those costs that will be borne by the district. Accounting procedures and how they're going to account for their receipts and their expenditures, the teachers and their names, who is included in that charter school, what their pupil-teacher ratio will be, the number of students that they will take. There's always a termination clause, how the district can terminate the school. That's in state statute that must exist. Compliance statement from the charter about how they will comply with all state and federal laws. And then the last piece in terms of the contract to conduct the charter itself is that the charter contract can't exceed 10 years in length. Couple things about the charter schools. They must keep financial records at the charter school level. They must regularly meet with their parents, and they must meet with their academic policy committee. That's actually laid out in statute as requirements.
We have a question. Representative Reinbold.
Really, just a quick one. It says that you have to have a termination in statute for charter schools. Is there also one for the local government neighborhood schools?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, there's not. The statute says that there has to be a termination clause for charter schools. It doesn't say that for neighborhood schools in statute. However, neighborhood schools are required to be available to serve the students in the enrollment area that they're in. So they certainly may need a restructure, but there isn't a termination clause in statute.
You know, and to follow along that same questioning, in statute, as you just mentioned, that the charter school is required, and I'll try to remember what you said, basically to have meetings with parents and to keep their own books. And what was the third thing that you mentioned?
They're required to meet with the parents and with the academic policy committee, which is their governing body.
Right. And what same type of requirement are the neighborhood schools required to do with, as far as, you know, we know they meet with their parents, but are they required to do those things?
Chair
Gaddis. Trying to see the balance between the neighborhood schools and the charter schools to see if there's a higher requirement for a charter school versus a neighborhood school.
Chair Gaddis, the financial records function is mostly conducted at the district level for those local schools. However, local schools do receive money, so they then have to fall within the district's procedure for receipt. Primarily, the receipt of money that they would get would be from activities, those kinds of things. And so they have to account for that at that school level, and then it goes through the district. So that's what makes them a little bit different, as they wouldn't establish their own procedures. And there's no reason a charter school couldn't work with the district to utilize the same procedures that those neighborhood schools use. And then the local schools are different in terms of their structure of the governing body. The governing body is the local school board. Traditionally, the school itself, it depends on the district, whether the principal does or does not meet with the local school board. That's typically the role of the superintendent, not the individual schools. And then generally, while it may be required in local policy, it isn't in statute that neighborhood schools must have parent meetings. That generally is true.
Although that was the question. Is it in statute? Must they? And I'm just trying to look at the differences between the two laws. And so what I'm hearing you say is it's not in statute that they must meet with the parents, although the charter schools must.
Chair Gaddis, that is true.
And you answered my question. Representative Seaton.
So I guess I'm trying to get the distinction here. Really, the requirement on the charter schools to do these things is because they are the governing body. So then those same things would be done by the district as the governing body for a local school. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's true in terms of the academic policy committee, the requirement that they meet with the academic policy committee. That would be true regarding that. In terms of meeting with parents, that's in statute for the charter schools. It's not in statute for the neighborhood schools. Does it occur? I can't imagine it doesn't. But where is it prescribed to occur? I think for neighborhood schools, it's prescribed locally versus at the state level.
And I think we could use that same, you know, would it happen if it wasn't prescribed? It's just interesting that it is mandated that charter schools do that, but it isn't with neighborhood schools. And I guess that was the distinction or the difference that I saw. Is it happening and would it happen? Maybe so. Follow-up, Representative Sir,
I guess my question is it required that school boards meet and have public meetings, or that their school board election? I mean, the governing body of the local schools is the school board. And so I guess, you know, we're mixing a neighborhood school as if it was a governing body, and we should, and the comparison is governing body to governing body. So anyway, that.
Thank you.
Chair Geddes, members of the committee, facility issues are also addressed in the contract. In the contract, the charter needs to lay out the facility needs they have and what facilities they will use, and that's outlined in the contract. Another note is statute does allow that a charter could exist within a neighborhood school facility or a district-owned facility if the space exists. And if the superintendent of that district deems that space meets all the health and safety standards that would be required. So an example would be if there is a facility that existed, but it wasn't actually a school. It was maybe used for something else within the district, and the charter wanted to use it, a warehouse. Well, the superintendent's going to have to deem that warehouse meets all the health and safety standards to be turned into a school before it can allow the charter to use that. But I think more often you would see a charter say, there's some empty rooms in this neighborhood school. Can we utilize them? And then the district, under statute, may allow that to occur. The district may allow that charter to be within their neighborhood school if space exists.
And if I could ask, it seemed like a key word, may, not shall.
The statute, and I confirmed it this weekend when I reread it.
You knew we were going to do this to you.
The statute said may.
Thank you.
Another piece that's important about charter schools is, you know, you have to apply to be admitted to a charter school, whereas neighborhood schools, you go to them, whichever is your neighborhood school, unless it's a district open enrollment procedure, and I don't know that we want to get into that level of detail. But if a charter school is unable to accommodate all the students that apply in a timely fashion, they do have to have a procedure in place where they randomly draw upon students to be allowed to go to that school. And that, again, is also in statute, that it be accepted by random drawing.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. That's my question, because I didn't understand that. So if they had room for only 30 students and 40 applied, then they have to do a drawing to see who gets to come?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
And you say that they get to choose their students, and there are qualifications. What goes into the selection process?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's the grade levels that they serve primarily. So they have to fit within the grade levels. And then generally there's an agreement in most charter schools for an engagement of parents. That's one thing. I may have not made that clear, but a big part of charter schools is heavy engagement of parents. And parent involvement can certainly look different. It's at any charter school, and actually within the charter school itself can look different for different parents based on what their ability is to contribute. So those are generally what those requirements are, is around making sure they're the right grade level, and then that they that the parents agree to have the child there and meet the transportation needs, anything like that.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
Obviously, I think parental involvement is a great thing, but I look at my district, East Anchorage, and there are plenty of students who, for one reason or another, they simply don't have engaged parents. So does that mean that if one of the students in my district, for example, decides You know, I would really like to learn Spanish and go to that charter school. I think there's one over on Government Hill. But his parents, his or her parents, they're not engaged. That opportunity is cut off for that student?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't know that that opportunity is cut off from those students. I would think that those charters would make accommodations for that. And I think that you have people that actually run charter schools who could probably better speak to that that's going to be speaking today.
Right, and we do have two charter schools that will have presentations. And I personally know that charter schools have made, I won't say exemptions, but accommodations for those that work full-time. I mean, there are many things that parents can do to be involved. They don't physically have to be there, and there are a lot of things that they can do to help out, be they field trips, so on and so forth. So we'll hear from them as we move along. Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
I realize that, but there are, honestly, many cases in which parents don't really wish to be engaged. And I'm more worried about the student than the parent. I'd like to see a student who wants to make something of themselves, regardless of what their family situation is, having that opportunity.
And
that's
we'll That's right. And we'll hear from the charter schools and see what kind of accommodations that they do. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would imagine just because one school, I mean, I know there's one school that really works much like a neighborhood school, and a lot of the people in that area, a lot of the students in that area go, and probably they don't have parents that get that involved. But I would imagine just because each school can make its own rules, each charter school can make its own rules, some charter schools have stricter rules for that than others.
Well, and I think and I'll go ahead and stop you there because we will hear from a couple charter schools and they have a better idea with what charter schools are doing across the state. And I won't put you on the hot seat. We'll put them on the hot seat. So carry on.
Next piece that I want to cover, again, I'm primarily covering state statutory
right.
cases, is regarding teachers and teachers assigned to the school. First off, if a teacher exists in the district already, under state statute, they must consent to being assigned to the charter school if the district wants to assign them to the charter school. The other important distinction is that the existing negotiated agreements that exist between the bargaining unit for the teachers and the district is true in the charter schools just as in neighborhood schools. In other words, the charter school teachers have to follow their bargaining agreement as well. And if there's any change to that, the bargaining unit leadership and the district must agree to that exemption. So there's an exemption from the teacher's contract, the collective bargaining contract. That exemption from that must be agreed to by the collective bargaining unit leadership and the district. Important distinction, I think. It isn't agreed to just by the teachers in the charter.
And if I might get you to back up just when the consent of the teacher to go to the charter school, is that same consent happening if you agree to go to a particular neighborhood school? I mean, is that any different?
Chair Gaddis, in most districts it's not. You can be reassigned. There's usually some priority order. It might be based on seniority. It might be based on qualifications. But generally, a district has the authority to reassign under certain rules within a school as well as within a school district from school to school.
And I guess I'm asking you, what is the thinking or the intent or the law? Why would a teacher not have to consent to go be reassigned to a neighborhood school, but they have to okay or agree to go to a charter school? What's the mindset, or do you know what the thinking was in law?
Representative Gaddis, to be absolutely certain, I'd have to go probably look at the legislative record, but I have a hunch that it's about making sure that that charter has teachers in it who are going to fulfill the instructional program that is different than the rest of the district, that is unique. And if that teacher says, I can't even teach in the way that they're teaching in that charter, it actually isn't helpful for the charter to place them there. So it allows, I think, that teacher who clearly won't be able to follow the prescribed curriculum that is different there to be assigned there.
And I guess I understand that, but what happens if they're transferred to a neighborhood school and they really can't, they don't have any choice? So, I mean, we're asking that we have teachers consent to a charter school, but they don't have that same consent to a neighborhood school. Again, there's a little bit of a lopside. Just making that comment. Representative Ledoux.
That was my saying.
Beat you to the punch. Carry on. Okay.
I was also asked to address funding, and so the way that the law reads is that the charter school is to not receive less than the amount generated by students enrolled in the neighborhood schools in terms of the amount of money that charter would receive, minus administrative costs that the district has for conducting certain things, and that administrative cost is an indirect rate that is approved by the department. Amount generated is in the same manner as in other districts. We think that there's some need for clarity around this. You may, actually, I'm certain you're going to hear from a couple of speakers and after me who can speak more to that clarity need based on what is occurring. But this is why the governor put forward in HB 278, Alaska's Education Opportunity Act, some clarification language around this in particular. And the budgets are to be used for operating expenses, including purchasing of textbooks, classroom materials, instructional aids. It also funds the staff within the school. That's really the state statutory language. When you examine our regulatory language, it really adds very little to the statute. It simply puts that in operational language, and the only thing is it clarifies that districts who approve or do not approve a charter school have 30 days after they take action to forward that to the state. Outside of that, the regulations that the state board has adopted really mirror the statute in terms of implementation.
Okay, and I have a quick question, so does Representative Reinbold. So to get back onto the funding, because and Representative Wilson after that, am I hearing you say that our charter schools are funded using the same formula that neighborhood schools are, or I should back up and say that school districts are in this case, on a per pupil basis?
Well, let me be really clear. The law actually says, I'm going to just read from the law if I can have permission to do so.
Yes.
It says, not less than the amount generated by students enrolled. So so that's the money that's on the table, is the amount of money that is generated by those students enrolled, which could be different because in a neighborhood school, the money is generated by that student, but the money doesn't go necessarily to the neighborhood school because there's district functions. The law is just trying to get clear, what money do we put on the table? Well, you put the money on the table that's generated by those students, just the way they're generated in other places. The further clarification I'd have is that a district might say, well, in this neighborhood school of 750, let's say we have two neighborhood schools of 750, if they decided to spread transportation funding to both charters as well as neighborhood schools, well, one neighborhood school might need three buses that has 750 students because kids live in a more compact way, and another might need 13 buses because kids don't live in a compact area. That happens right here in Juneau. However, a charter might have a different scenario where they have a need in the district. In some districts, they do. They agree to bus the students into that charter school if they live within the enrollment area that charter is within. And in other cases, they don't. So the piece that we're proposing in statute or that the bill is proposing that the governor's put forward is to bring clarity around that so that it's clear what money is included in that.
So you just spoke of transportation, but you didn't speak of facility, taxes, and other things. So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's an even playing field when they start, neighborhood charter schools, as far as finances are concerned. And then from a financial standpoint, we start taking, in this case, if the neighborhood school does not have to pay for their lease on their building, but the charter school does. So that'll take away from that generated funds that you discussed.
Chair Gattis, what I was speaking to is correct. How much gets on the table?
Right.
We believe that some clarity around that language about how much gets on the table is necessary. And then the next piece is right. They have to look at, within the contract, what is the lease cost for that charter. If it has a lease cost, then it has to be built into that budget. The neighborhood school doesn't have that. It's not to say they don't have facility needs, though, and that their facilities don't have to be cared for. It's just handled differently.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay, and my question of thinking is pretty similar. They don't have bonding ability for their facilities. And also, I believe it's $470 per student for transportation costs. I was reading this weekend that in many of the school districts, they do provide charter school transportation, but in Anchorage, they do not. So what happens to the $470 for all the charter school kids for their transportation? Where does that go?
And if I could stop you, because we did discuss this on Friday, and we spent a long time on it, I don't really want to go backwards,
okay.
But I will get with Representative Reinbold. And if you give us a short answer, we won't go down that trail again.
Well, let me give a short answer on the bonding,
please.
If I could, because the charter has the same right to bond as does a neighborhood school. They really don't. Schools don't have the right
That's
to
right.
bond. The district and the municipality do. The district has the ability to go to the municipality to bond. If a charter is in a building that is an asset to that school district and insured by that school district, they have the same right. Are they successful getting there or not? That's a whole nother set of things that you have to look at to whether they would meet the criteria to bond. But if they're in a leased facility, there would be problems with that because bonding is for district assets that are insured by the district.
And I guess to speak to the bonding, I certainly have in my district a charter school that has tried every which way but loose to bond, to be part of owning the building, to have the municipality own the building. I mean, it goes around and around. And the unfortunate part is they're leasing a building that is not necessarily fulfilling their needs. In this case, it's a Spanish immersion school. So in order to start the kids out, it's difficult to get somebody in fifth grade when you've immersed the kids starting from first grade. So they can take the fifth graders. You've got to take from first grade on so that their program is able to be continued on, and they cannot expand. They've got a very expensive lease. They're paying the property taxes on top of it. So it's a huge, huge challenge. I know that I've gotten calls from Representative Reinbold's district in which they're trying to look at a charter school and having a heck of a time trying to bond as well.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I think we understand that it becomes a municipal building. And so there is a process. It's just tougher. There's a catch-22 for the charter schools for sure. Representative Wilson, then we'll go back to Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I understand you to say that if a charter school has a building that's within the school district and considered part of the school district, that it has to meet codes?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. It would have to meet code regardless whether it's in the district or not in the district. The only distinction I was making is if it was using a facility within the district, let's say they wanted to use a warehouse. Well, the superintendent of the district is going to have to deem that that warehouse can be brought up to code to have students in it before that could be approved. But if they're in a leased facility, they're in any facility, they must meet the requirements, safety and health requirements required of any school in the state.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
I just wanted to go back to our subcommittee finance closeout and just, I know there's a lot of elementary schools. We've increased our elementary school by 2 million square foot in Anchorage as the population has gone down for our schools by about 2,000 between 1993 and 2013. So it just seems appropriate to repurpose or at least combine some schools, possibly open up room for some of the charter schools so we don't have to build new or pay expensive rent. I know Eagle Charter Academy is the second top performing government school in the district, yet they are in very poor conditions overall with outhouses around and not an appropriate playground and on and on and on. Their lease is running out this coming May, so they're under a lot of pressure. And so I don't feel like we're supporting success. Here's success, a beautiful, you know, model of success, but they're under very difficult circumstances trying to find a building. So I'm just hoping that we learn to possibly repurpose some of the buildings that we have and accommodate some of these charter schools and treat them with more, you know, partnership throughout the district.
And great comments, Representative Reinbold. We'll be taking amendments to this bill, and you're certainly welcome to bring some of those to the table. Representative Ledoux.
This is not a question. This is a question to you, Chair Gaddis. Have we gotten the memo from Legislative Legal with respect to what the change this new bill means when it comes to transportation funding, facilities funding, et cetera? Because the way that some of us were reading this language and the way Superintendent Hanley, or Commissioner Hanley, was describing the language, there was a disconnect somewhere. And I thought we had asked Legislative Legal for something.
And we have asked. We don't have anything back yet, and I think even the commissioner indicated that, you know, we'll look at that and we'll move forward with that information.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for reminding us, and it's still on the table. You may continue.
That's the end of my presentation.
Oh, thank you. Any other questions before we let him off the hot seat? Okay, we do have two charter schools, and I think we'll call on, and for the record, the paperwork passed out. We'll call on Joey Eska with the Aquarian Charter School. And for our information, we have three pieces of paper. And they were provided by Aquarian Charter School. The first one is labeled Anchorage Charter School Facilities Analysis, just so you know where it came from. The second one starts off with the 2012/2013 audited ASD financials. Again, that's from Joey Eska, the APC chair from Aquarian Charter School. And then the third one is labeled Alaska Charter Schools Legislator Information. Again, Aquarian Charter School. So put it on the record where we got our documentation so we'll know as we move on. Joey, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
If you'll please put yourself on the record, and we're ready for your presentation. And sometimes through this process, it's a little bit difficult to interrupt, but I'm sure I'll be interrupting, asking questions. So I hope you'll bear with us. So
you may begin. Absolutely, and I will try to follow format as well.
Okay.
My name is Joey Eske. I am the chair of Aquarian Charter School's Academic Policy Committee. Aquarian is a charter school in Anchorage, Alaska. I wanted to thank you all for inviting me back to testify today. And before I start, I would actually like to personally thank Representative Gaddis for her attention to charter schools and her recognition that they are amazing and innovative learning environments. I think without her support, we wouldn't be talking about charter schools today. So, Aquarian Charter School means different things for different families. For my family, it's a sound education in a nurturing environment that's created by involved parents and magical teachers. All three of our children are at Aquarian currently. When my daughter Ivy, who is now in sixth grade, reached kindergarten age, my husband and I started looking at schools. We quickly realized the role a school plays in a child's development, and we, like most parents, wanted a school that she would love and that she would flourish in. We were searching for that something special. So when we started looking around, it was incredible. The choices in Anchorage are really amazing. We have a really good neighborhood school. The number of optional and alternative schools were a bit overwhelming, but it was all said and done. We chose Aquarian Charter School, and we were actually lucky enough to lottery into this school, which I watched many people not get in and be very disappointed. So For us, Aquarian is that something special. It's a very open, comfortable learning environment, and it has a tailored approach to children's learning. We use a differentiated model for children, and we really cater to that child's highest level of achievement. So, Aquarian is one of 8 charter schools operating in the Anchorage School District. 2 of the charter schools are homeschool programs. 1 is a German immersion program. We have a Native Cultures Charter School. We also have a Waldorf-inspired school. We have Eagle Academy, which is a academically rigorous ABC school, and like one of your representatives mentioned, very, very high-performing school. We also have Highland Tech, which is serves grades 6 through 12, and they use a standards-based learning model for their program. We were very excited because we had a newly approved middle school coming online. It's a STREAM Academy with a focus on technology and outdoor education. But unfortunately, they were unable to secure a building, and they will not be able to open this coming school year. So we're hoping maybe.
Thank you, Joey. And this is what we're going. We're going to try our cumbersome interruptions. But Representative Ledoux has a question.
Okay.
I don't see on this list the Spanish immersion program. Is it there and I'm missing it, or is that an alternative school rather than a charter school?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is actually an alternative school.
Thank you.
It may have started as a charter school and then converted to an optional school or alternative school, but currently it is an alternative school.
And we have a question, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate it. Can you tell me what the name of the school once again was that was unable to open because they could not find a building?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Reingold, it is STREAM Academy. It's actually being started by a group of educators rather than a group of parents. So it's a different model than we've seen before. But people are really excited about it. Technology and mathematics and outdoor learning is kind of their focus.
Follow-up, Representative Reinbold.
Okay, and, you know, I'm really, this definitely has caught my attention because I know there's a lot of elementary schools that are right around 80% capacity, and it just really seems like if we did a little bit of restructuring, we could repurpose some of these and open up opportunities for students. In Muldoon, there's an opportunity for accommodation, and also in Eagle River, there's certainly opportunity. So, if you could send us information through the chair about this and how the difficulties that they found, because I'm considering an amendment to look at repurposing already existing buildings because our capital budget is going to be less. And so at this point in time, we really do need to try to streamline some of our buildings. We've increased the floor space by 2 million in the last 20 years in Anchorage, yet we've gone down about 2,000 students, so there's definitely room, and so we just need to reprioritize. So thank you very much for your testimony.
And Joey, this is Representative Gaddis. If you could just connect us with the folks or one of the teachers that tried to put the program together, we can go through the rest of the information if you don't have it. We do
sure,
have a question.
Absolutely.
We have a question. Representative Ledoux.
On Friday, we learned that the school district, while not providing transportation to the charter schools, was providing transportation to the Rogers Park alternative school. Do you know whether it also provides transportation to the other alternative schools, such as the Government Hill Spanish Immersion Program?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, my understanding is they do not provide transportation to the other charter or optional and alternative schools. The only school that I know of that they provide transportation to is the Rogers Park Highly Gifted Alternative Program.
Do you have any idea of what the thinking was of the Anchorage School District to choose just one school to provide transportation and not the others?
And I would recommend, Joey, be careful trying to determine what somebody else's thinking was. So
I really cannot. Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you.
Enjoy at this point. Please continue.
Okay. All of these schools, all these charter schools were started as a result of the idea of a group of inspired individuals who saw a perceived need in education. typically a group of parents, but in, like I mentioned, Stream's case, it is a group of educators. Forming a charter school is the most effective way to get an innovative education model started in our district, and I venture to say started in the state. What many people don't realize, and you guys have actually been discussing it, is that once these charter schools are open and started, then they are governed by an APC or a group of individuals. Most APCs are composed of parents, teachers, staff. Sometimes a community member is invited to sit in on the board. And then this APC is responsible for making all the budget and curricular decisions of the school. If a school is fortunate to have to be able to afford a principal, typically they will hire a principal. The APC hires the principal. The principal reports to the APC, is hired and fired by the APC, but is actually a district employee and also has to report to the district. So the principal kind of straddles who they report to.
This is Representative Gaddis. I have a question for you. You indicated that if the charter school was fortunate enough to have a principal, and I don't understand what you mean by that. Maybe you could expand on it a little bit.
Representative Gaddis. Well, it's basically budget driven. So a lot of times, for instance, Winterberry Charter School, the parents that started that and the teachers, one of the parents, and she's now the current principal, she, in the school startup, she was slated to be a teacher. They couldn't afford a principal, so she filled that spot unpaid, and learned through the years of experience how to be a principal and was eventually certified. But so their school operated for a number of years without a principal before they actually had one. There are schools around the state that will use like a lead teacher instead of a principal, and it's all budget driven. So if you have to have some type of an administrator in the charter school, it does not have to be a principal. And like I said, it's purely budget driven. Can you afford it or not? And you know, you make choices between putting another teacher in the classroom and putting a principal in an administrative seat.
And thank you. You answered it very well. And certainly, I understand the budgetary concerns. I just wasn't aware that we have charter schools or neighborhood schools, for that matter, that do or don't have principals in them. So you clarified. You may continue. Thank you.
Okay. And I can't speak to neighborhood schools. I'm not sure if there are neighborhood schools without principals, just
Thank
charter
you.
Schools. But the principal in the school, if they have one, is delegated to manage the school, the day-to-day operations, all of the human resources issues, and the building, make sure the building is facilitated. And then they bring any major changes in any decisions to the APC before they are made. Aquarian Charter School is one of the longest-running charter schools in Anchorage and in the state. It was started in 1997 by a group of parents who wanted a stress-free learning environment for gifted and high-achieving children. They focused on the use of brain-based learning and differentiated instruction. They accompanied this with high expectations, but they set it in a very warm, encouraging environment. Over the years, our school's teaching model and methods have evolved, as has our population of students. We are no longer an exclusive school of only gifted students. We do maintain the requirement to challenge each child at their individual level, and we do encourage students to reach their highest potential of achievement, all in a warm, stress-free environment. Our school uses the differentiated learning model so that children are learning at their individual level. It's not uncommon to walk into a classroom and have 4 to 5 different writing levels, reading levels, spelling levels, all happening at the same time. Additionally, our school uses a blocked math period and the Saxon math curriculum, which is unlike the district, for an hour and 15 minutes each day. Each child in the school moves to whatever math level they are in. Doesn't matter if they're higher or lower, but they move to their math level. Every single teacher in our school teaches math. So whether they are a PE teacher, an art teacher, a music teacher, they spend the time each day teaching math, and they're all highly qualified math teachers. It's a requirement of being a teacher at our school. We found great success in this math model. It really gives children the ability to enjoy math because they're not bored or they're not pushed so hard that it's too hard. Another thing that Aquarian does is each quarter we have these interesting explorations where we just put academics behind for a day, sometimes two in one quarter, 2 days, and we delve into topics. So just this last week, the students they learned about the history of the Olympics, some of them. Some of them did the physics of toys. Some of them went to the dome and did athletics. So we're able to do really innovative, interesting things that a neighborhood school might be able to replicate, but it would be harder. So Aquarian, like I said, has the benefit of being 17 years old, and we have grown and evolved over this time. One of our biggest challenges, and maybe the biggest challenge of any charter school faces, is finding a facility, and once you have that facility, paying for that facility. It's a game right now for schools that are in their growth periods. Particularly our German school is struggling with this, but you need to grow your count, your enrollment, in order to receive more funding. But once you grow the enrollment, then you need more space, and you need to pay more for the space. So it's kind of this evolving problem of what's the right size to be and what can you afford, basically. Aquarian Charter School in specific is housed in a once-condemned, vacated, fully depreciated Anchorage School District building. It's really a number of portables combined with no foundation. It has a single multi-purpose room that is used for PE, lunch, assemblies, evening events, and everything in between. Our current enrollment is 383 students, and we are busting at the seams. Our school's wait list is over 800 students, and that doesn't include incoming kindergartners. Rent and maintenance takes over $350,000 out of our operating budget each year, but when you look at Aquarian, we have it the best of any school in Anchorage. We have it good compared to the other schools. The native charter school pays $640,000 a year to be in also a once-condemned building that was a private school. Rocha Shula, the German school, pays $750,000 a year.
Hold it. Joey, could you go back to the condemned building statement?
Sure, about the native charter school.
Yeah,
they just moved into the Pacific Northern Academy building. The Pacific Northern Academy moved across town. And so it's an old, reconditioned building, so they had to bring it up to code before they could move in. I believe it was around the sprinkler system, but I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that there was neighborhood school that moved out and a charter school brought it up to speed. Is that what you're saying?
It was a private school. Pacific
you're right,
Academy
you're right.
Is a private school. Was in there, and they moved. I think it was more cost-effective for them to move than to bring the building up to code. And then I don't know the details of it, but the native charter school came in and through various grants, I believe, and were able to bring the building to code, but they still have to pay rent to Pacific Northern Academy each year.
Right, and I certainly don't want to assume something that we don't know, and I know that we have Principal Gerard on the line, and I know she'll speak to reappropriated buildings that she's...
Sure.
So, please go on.
Okay. Our Winterberry School, which is our Waldorf and Spire School, pays $400,000 in rent. They just went out, and I believe this also happened in the Valley, so Principal Gerard may be able to speak to it. They actually contracted with a private contractor in town to have a school built. The contractor built it, and now Winterberry is renting it over a 20-year period. I believe it's $400,000 a year plus $50,000 in property taxes. And then they have the right to purchase it after 20 years. But the problem is this, you know, $50,000 in property taxes is really hurting them. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to be a public school and be paying property taxes, I guess.
And Joey, this is Representative Gaddis again.
Yes.
And I'm not real familiar with that particular program, but it would seem to me that they're paying... And I don't know if you don't know the contract, but I think what I heard you say is that they're going to rent at a certain fee for X amount of years, and after that there must be some portion of their rent that's being applied to the principal and that which allows them to buy it. Is that what you're saying?
You know, I don't know the specifics. How it's been explained to me is that they have a period of time that they're renting at a set rental amount, and then at the end I know that they have a purchase of $3.1 million. So I'm not sure. The amount has already been set in today's prices. But I don't, that's the extent of my understanding of their contract. But when they looked around, they actually, they had to use their supplies budget for a year, and they hired a contractor to come in and actually search all of Anchorage for a facility for them. And there weren't, they came back with absolutely no facilities available.
So really what I'm hearing you say is that the charter schools have to do some creative financing and really have to jump through a lot of hoops. And that's what I get. I want to put on the record that you indicated that folks leasing private buildings either have in the lease or have to pay outside of the lease property taxes, which neighborhood school do not.
That is correct.
And you may continue.
Okay. All charter schools in Alaska operate on a very tight budget, and Anchorage charter schools receive the base student allocation adjusted for our enrollment factors, so school size, the special needs factor, the career and technology, the quality grants. But that is all we receive. We do not consistently receive state grant dollars. We do not receive a significant portion of our local tax dollars. As you found out, we do not receive transportation or capital project monies. From the smaller amount, we pay all of our school's operating expenses, including teacher salaries, benefits, addenda, copiers, textbooks, and supplies. But uniquely, charter schools also have to pay for their facilities, including rent and maintenance, in some place construction and costs. This is a burden that other types of schools in our state and districts don't bear from their operating budgets. On average, Anchorage charter schools spend 25% of their operating budget to cover facilities-related expenses, leaving only 75% of BSA funds to be used for direct student instruction. So this is right out of our operating fund. The district overall spends approximately 10% out of their general fund monies on facilities, but they also have access to capital funds and bonding for building acquisition, renovation, and major maintenance needs. As I have listened to your initial discussion on Wednesday and Friday regarding charter school funding, I have a great appreciation for the complexity of the many issues your committee is facing. Personally, I'm a CPA by training, and I have been working with Aquarian's budget for over 5 years, and still I spend hours shuffling through the details of public state funding formula and our school budget and the district budget, trying to figure out how to fix our charter school funding dilemma. As a collective group of charter schools, we have come to the conclusion that although we all have our own unique needs, inequity in facility funding is the single most significant challenge hindering charter school growth and sustainability. It also happens to be the largest barrier to new charter school startup. And if you're open to them, we have some recommendations that we think as a collective group might be helpful to us. Is that appropriate to bring forward?
Yes.
So the things that we think would really help us, and Mr. Morse spoke to clarity around funding, and that's definitely something that would help our charter schools. But the things that we're recommending, first, as they relate to facilities, we would think that an establishment of an annual state-funded per pupil facilities allowance that was based on an average district need would be really helpful for charter schools. That would take the onus off the district in terms of trying to always struggle for money within the districts. And as we are, state-established schools, I think if we could get a portion of money directed on a per-pupil basis directly from the state, that would be very helpful for charter schools. With that, we would request a corresponding rollover exemption. So charter schools can save money for facilities. Right now, we bump up against the 10% cap on the district's general fund of any monies that we try to save for a facility. The second thing would be the reinstatement and funding of a competitive state-funded grant program for facilities. We would like proven programs and programs that have shown their sustainability and their success with their student models to be able to apply for some type of a grant program. The third would be expanded language regarding first right of refusal to occupy closed or unused or underused public school facilities or property. We would like those to be, we'd like charter schools to be able to use those without rental payments, but we think it's fair for the charter school and the district to negotiate the, to cover the maintenance and the cost of inhabiting the building. The fourth thing as it relates to facilities is we would request an exemption from local property taxes for properties housing public charter schools. It is my understanding that there's some kind of contradiction in statutory versus regulatory laws that that makes this happen. Our asks as they relate to funding would be, number one, changes in state law requiring logical funding from local, state, and federal sources to follow the public charter school student. As you have heard, we do receive the state funding formula, whereas the district receives funding from other sources, extra local property taxes, different types of state grants, federal grants, and capital monies. And those are things that is at a district's discretion whether to pass down or not. And we would just like clarity around that in terms of it being fair. And we're looking for parity.
And Joey, this is Representative Gaddis, and I just can't help mulling over this. So if I'm hearing you correctly, the charter school pays property taxes because they don't own the building, but they don't receive their share of those same property taxes that the rest of the neighborhood schools own. Is that what I'm hearing you say, at least in the Anchorage School District?
Madam Chair, yes. Well, here's my understanding of it, and I will explain it. So when you look at a charter school's funding, we receive the state funding formula. And as part of that state public school funding program or formula, the local municipality has a required contribution. So we would receive monies out of the local tax dollars from the local required contribution. What we don't receive is any additional monies for any additional property taxes a municipality puts in. So, for example, let's look at the 2012-2013 school year. The Anchorage municipality of Anchorage was required to put in $95.5 million into the state funding formula. That was their required contribution. So that $95.5 million was distributed to the charter schools on a per-pupil basis. But the municipality also funded the school district an additional $97 million that was outside of the public school funding formula. And so all of that money, the $97 million that was passed through as local property taxes, was not passed to the charter school students. So by our calculations, we're receiving about half of the local monies.
And thank you, Joey. That's the part that I wanted to put on record, and you did a good job with your CPA brain and language. It really did help us. So continue on, Joey. Thanks so much.
Okay. Our final and recommendation would be a reasonable state-mandated cap on indirect fees charter schools pay to the local districts. There's some confusion over how it's set, who it's set, what it covers. I think we really want to pay our share of the services we use from a district. We understand we use their human resources, their accounting systems. We use some of their training. We use their technology. So we're not opposed to having an indirect fee, but the indirect fee is very, it fluctuates significantly. It's anywhere from 2 to 6% in a given year, and we don't find out about it until the very last minute. And for a charter school, what ends up happening is you budget, we have significantly smaller budgets, so we budget, and then we get an assessment of the indirect fee, and then the next thing you know, we have to cut staff. So we're just looking for consistency in that, and we've looked over the years, and we've tried to look at the financial statements, at least in Anchorage, and we believe that 4%, a 4% cap is reasonable for those indirect fees. We understand the funding items that I've just mentioned, the funds to follow a public charter school student and a cap on the indirect fees do have impacts on the district's budget. And as charter schools, we are very willing to work with their districts and make logical changes, even phase them in over time so there's not a drastic impact on the district. But I think what we're asking from you is some language in the charter school laws that actually dictate what the district should share with us, what makes sense, what's logical. As charter schools, we're not asking for big changes. Despite Alaska's lackluster national charter school ranking, you know, our charter school system really is quite ingenious. It allows for innovation in education and public choice in Alaska's for Alaska's families, but not at the expense of accountability. Working with our local districts gives charter schools credibility and ensures high educational standards. We're not asking for a complete revamping of charter school law, but we would like to see positive changes that encourage the local districts to work with the charter schools, allowing them to grow. Charter schools, at least in Anchorage, have been asking for funding equity for many years, and we think House Bill 78 and House Bill 93 are good starts, and we think the intent is there, and we really look forward to working with your committee and our governor to strengthen the provisions. I think the number one thing that we're asking for is a state-funded per-pupil facilities allowance. This is the quickest and fastest way to get help to those charter schools that have concerns of even making it through the next school year. So that's our main goal is to be able to be sustainable, grow for the future, and meet the demands of our state students.
Thank you, Joey, and we have a couple of questions. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the funding above the required to the cap. On your paper on page one, it's also talking about federal dollars for military families. Are you looking at the federal government pays the Anchorage School District a certain amount for military kids that are attending school, and depending upon how many of those attend Aquarian, is that what you're looking for? I'm just unclear.
Yes, I mean for the federal monies, I think it's easy to be unclear because the structure of it is very complicated, and it doesn't impact a lot of the charter schools. But I know that the charter school that out in Eagle River has a number of military students because they're close to base. So what we would like is some forthright sharing if those children, you know, earned the right for the district to get money from the federal government, that it be passed forward to them on a logical basis.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
So you're talking on a pro rata basis of funding that's provided for students depending upon how many go to the charter school, not a per pupil basis just on how many kids are in your school versus how many kids are in the entire Anchorage School District?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. Just for the students that earned the money, not for all students.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold.
Joey, that was a fabulous presentation. I took so many notes, but I would sure like to get a copy of those. I'm sure that the chair will request that. But first of all, I just want to make a comment. Good job for thriving under challenging conditions, especially financial conditions. It's really impressive, your wait list. You got to be doing a lot of things right to generate a 800-student wait list. And I know I'm very thankful that the chair has brought charter schools to our forefront. I'm also very passionate about this, and so please count on me to help make some of these changes or help put many of these suggestions forward with the chair. I'm very, very excited about these, and I just want to say congratulations. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I too want to say that this has helped me understand some things a lot better than I had before. However, one thing I want you to go into a little bit more, you're not permitted to keep anything that you have left over if you were able to save anything. You're not you're not allowed to keep that to roll over for the next year?
And if I could interrupt here, this is Representative Gaddis. I think it's great to have Joey, who is a CPA and understands that, to be able to explain that. So I appreciate that lapse fund question. And Joey, if you could explain what I think a business person understands, that if we want to save for a rainy day, how you can't save for a rainy day because of the lapse funds, and how that how the district, how it goes against the district's 10%. And maybe you could explain that, because I think that's really important.
Sure, through the chair and Representative Wilson. My understanding of it is that the districts in the state have a 10% cap on any general funds that are not encumbered. So they are not allowed to hold more than 10% of kind of a savings account. All of the charter schools' school budgets are run through the districts. So any money that we have sitting in an account, which is not very much usually, it's counted as part of the district's 10% rollover cap. So what has happened in the past is we actually had a situation where one of the homeschool charter schools won a lawsuit of some type that I'm not fully versed on, and they had a significant amount of money sitting in their accounts. And Anchorage School District told them they could not have that money sitting there, that they had to use it, otherwise they had to turn it over, I believe, to the district. I'm not clear on that, what would happen to the money if they weren't able to spend it. But they were very creative. They actually purchased our computers for our school. We were not part of the computer technology refreshment that the Anchorage School District did for all of the neighborhood schools. They left charter schools out, and we were in desperate need of computers. So we share our building with the other charter schools, especially the homeschool. When they need to do testing, we let them use our multi-use purpose room. And we've always let them use our computers. So they actually used the money to purchase our computers, some of it. I know they did all kinds of creative things to spend that money. Now the district came back to the charter schools and said, you can't roll money over. You can't have old monies. So the charter schools each year have to go to the district and say, we have encumbered such amount for supplies next year. Aquarian tries to save enough to pay their rent year to year, but we have to get special permission to hold on to that money from the district.
Thank you, Joey. And we do have a couple of other questions. But so if I'm hearing you correctly, you do pay your rent through the summer when you're not holding school as well. Is that correct?
You know, we have an annual lease.
Ah, okay. Which includes all the 12 months, I suspect. And good explanation on the lapse funds. That's certainly the way that I understood them to be, too. Unfortunately, from a business standpoint, it's a challenge to think that you should be able to save some of your money for a rainy day, which you know you're going to need. And if you save up the next 4 or 5 years, there you go with your refreshing for your technology or so on and so forth. I have another question by Representative Wilson. I couldn't remember down at the end here. I knew one of them. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think because a lawsuit was involved in that, we're really going to have to make a change there. We're going to have to really get technical and decide how to do that. It's not going to be just an easy amendment, I don't think. But I would like to see that change at least so that they can hold over, because some of them want to build a building or whatever. So I would like to ask the Department of Education to look at that and see how that can be changed in law so that we aren't violating that lawsuit that took place.
I understand the question.
Thank you.
And so we'll look at it as well. Any other questions before? We've got about half an hour for our last presenter, so we'll be quick. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the transportation, can you define for us or identify how the transportation for your students, how they get to school and who pays for that?
Yes, through the chair. We actually, the parents at Aquarian Charter School are required to provide transportation to students.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I have a question. If this would pass as it is, where transportation, the $459 per student, would be allocated or into the as an amount generated by students into the budget, would Aquarian want to get that $459 as money that you would have available to fund your school, or would you want the district to provide buses?
Madam Chair, Representative Seaton, if for Aquarian, I can only speak for Aquarian in this respect, our goal would really to be to work with the district in terms of, we would love to have busing for all of our students. We don't know if that's a reasonable goal. But we are very concerned about students that can't get here because of economic situations, or I believe it was Representative Ledoux that was talking about a parent that is unable for whatever reason to be involved. We would still like access for those children to be able to come to our school. We do have a lot of parent involvement, and part of it is that they do drive their children each day and pick them up. Our parent involvement, we request that parents volunteer. We cannot require parents to volunteer at the school, but we do have a lot of parent involvement, and a piece of it is, if you are going to commit to our school, you're committing to getting your child there by 8:15 each morning and picking them up at 3:15.
Thank you, and we have one last question before we move to our next presenter, Representative Reinbold.
Okay, thank you. This is definitely caught my ear. I've heard somewhere between $459 and $470 goes to transportation funding, and it just seems to me that this funding should follow the student. It is absolutely unimaginable to me that this is not following the student, either through the parents for reimbursement for gas, and certainly wouldn't cover their time, or at least if we can set up some sort of a minivan or airport van service to help, especially these kids that are in tough economic situations. So I am definitely supportive of this portion of the bill, that the funding should follow, so at least in some ways these charter schools can become more equitable. So thank you very much for addressing this.
One last small question. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I appreciate the spreadsheet that you've given us that shows the per student allocation at Aquarian is $7,857. Could you forward us a breakout of how that's generated? And I'm speaking of the sheet that's on Anchorage Charter School facilities analysis. So is that per student allocation talking about facilities, or is that for the BSA portion that Aquarian gets?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is the BSA funding that Aquarian Charter School receives per student. And that is what, like I said, with the school funding program formula, so that takes into account our school size. That gives us the special needs factor and the career and tech factor, and then the quality school grants, and that is net of the indirect cost that the district withholds.
Okay, that's net. Madam Chair, that satisfies me, that explanation.
Right, although I must say that I'm a little bit confused, but maybe it's just verbiage. What I heard is that's the BSA, and what that is that's the, is it the adjusted daily membership through the formula? What, at net? The indirect. Is that what I thought I heard you say?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
And may I say for the record that I made these spreadsheets so based from ASD information on the web. And the charter school facilities analysis, that is, you can find this information right on our website of what each school gets, and then the facilities expense. We all meet together so we know our facilities expense. And then the enrollment is online. So that's my calculation there. The second spreadsheet I was using to try to demonstrate which funding revenues we receive and which we don't. And once again, this is this is my handiwork, so I can say it's as accurate as the information online.
And Joey, you did a great job describing through your presentation, and thank you very much for letting us interrupt you and ask throughout, and a great presentation. Right now we have on Barbara Gerard from Academy Charter, and thank you for staying on, and hopefully you're still with us. Barbara?
Yes, good morning, Representative Gaddis, House Education Committee members. First, I wanted to echo Joey's praise and thanks for Representative Gaddis's work to try to alleviate some of charter schools' frustrations and the things that we face that makes our lives difficult. So I'm going to hit on a few things, facility costs, funding, and special education. MATSU, and I'll focus mostly on MATSU. So I'll begin with funding. Can I back up,
Barbara? Could you put yourself on the record?
I apologize.
My fault. I'm sorry.
My name is Barbara Gerard. I am the principal of Academy Charter School in Palmer, Alaska.
Thank you. Continue.
All right. In 1997, when we opened, we only Academy Charter School and Midnight Sun, which were the two first charter schools in MATSU, only received a portion of the state funding. Senate Bill 36 passed, which allowed for a basic need per student, which forced districts to provide that charter schools minimally receive the state foundation funding for education, similar as to other public schools. One of the big differences is that we pay an indirect back. In 2007, a MATSU charter school received about $5,300 per student, and then we paid the district back 3.98% of an indirect fee. Now, we did not receive the local tax appropriation. And this continued with this type of arrangement, with the indirects fluctuating each year, ranging from 4.85 one year to 3.42 the next year, which created a difficulty in budgeting. In 2010, Academy Charter Schools families, along with the other charter schools, we have six in MATSU, joined together to approach the borough for approval for the local taxpayers' piece to follow the child. At that point, Superintendent Troxell and Assistant Superintendent John Wheatman agreed to reduce our indirect fee to 0.5% if we would not go for the full local tax appropriation. We agreed. And then 3 years ago, we were able to, actually it was 2 years ago, we were able to negotiate to receive the full local tax appropriation, which is about $2,800 per student, in exchange to pay the current indirect fee that is determined by Department of Education, similar to they fund grants. So currently, MATSU charter schools receive the base allocation from the state, as well as the local tax appropriation, and then we pay back a percentage for our indirect. We've seen as high as 6.96%. It dropped to 5.76, and it adds up, if you total the six charter schools, to be about $800,000 we pay back in indirect fees to our district.
And so, Barbara, if I can interrupt you here, this is Representative Gaddis. I just want to be real clear for the record. Who sets those indirect fee amounts? Is it the Department of Education or is it the school district?
It's my understanding that the school district completes a form that is used for this calculation, and it's submitted to Department of Education, and in which that federal indirect rate is calculated each year. And I actually have a piece of paper that was supplied to me from our district that, you know, shows the Massachusetts School District application and district certification request for an authorized indirect rate, and then the Department of Education response, and your proposal was accepted, and it has, and then they give you an actual 5.58%. So if that helps.
And I think it does. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the school district itself uses those calculations and turns around and charges you for that then?
Yes. Yep. And that's the indirect rate that we pay. The challenge is that it fluctuates. So our budgeting is always, each year, you know, a major concern because we don't quite know how much money we'll have. And there's also discussion as to what numbers is used to generate those costs at the local school district, and should charter schools bear the same you know, rate comparison. And that's one of our requests, is to have a set indirect fee that doesn't fluctuate. And we're thinking somewhere around 3%. Which would help us greatly with our annual budgeting, as well as being able to help with expectations.
Representative Seaton.
I was wondering if you could forward that sheet to us. It's hard for us to follow the numbers.
I think that's a great idea. If you'll send it to me, Barbara, I'd appreciate it, and I'll make sure that the committee gets it. It's kind of, and I'd agree with Representative Seaton, it's a challenge to try to figure out in our minds what that whole process and then the back process is. So if you have a copy of that, if you don't have a copy, let me know, and we'll try to find a copy somewhere.
I have a copy of that. It was supplied to me by Becky Wright at the school district. So
appreciate it. And Barbara, if you'll continue, we have about 15, 16 minutes, and I'd want to be sure to cover any questions if we have them. So please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next piece that is troubling for charter schools is the facility cost. five of the six charter schools within MAPSU have to undertake a extremely large lease in order to be able to provide a facility for those, our schools. If you total up our local leases of our charter schools, it adds up to over $1 million paid into private hands in order to house charter school students. And then on top of that, there's the local taxes that's added on top of it. Birch Tree, for example, pays $75,000 in taxes. Midnight Sun pays somewhere about $50,000 per year. So these are additional chunks that have to come out of the operation budget, which is designed to go into the classroom, not to have to pay for facilities and taxes. Another piece is we'd like to see repurpose of old schools so that charter schools might be able to use that, especially in a situation that the first 3 years of a charter school is very challenging, because you're not only you know, implementing all your great ideas, you are you know, having to find a facility and those type of things. If we could have an incubator facility created from some of those old buildings, such as Iditarod Elementary is going to be coming online soon, that would allow for charter schools to be able to practice and develop and then earn the right to maybe possibly apply for an 80-20 bond. So those are some of the things we hope.
Thank you, Barbara. And we have a couple questions. I guess for on the record, I'd like to ask you, in regards to the taxes that the charter schools pay in the Mat-Su borough, can you clarify what we're doing now?
Yes, Madam Chair. We are currently, the charter schools pay their leases, and then there is an additional cost that or a tax bill that is, you know, that's given to the charter schools to pay, just as you would if you were the owner of the building, except that it's really a pass-through from the private owners.
Okay, and I guess what I really wanted to put on record, because I happen to know some of our assembly persons are listening online in the Mat-Su, what the Mat-Su Borough Assembly has agreed to do, and I know it's not in statute or whatever, but what are we doing on that pass back of the taxes?
It's difficult for me to speak to that because we Academy Charter School happens to be having benefited from a legislative direct appropriation, so we don't have to lease our building. So I don't know off the ins and out of that. I apologize.
And I guess I do, so I will put it on the record.
Thank you.
And for those assembly persons listening, I know that the Mat-Su School District works very well with its assembly, and I think the Mat-Su Borough Assembly has recognized that this was not fair, that the neighborhood schools did not pay property taxes, but the charter schools did. So there is certainly a hand-holding agreement that they have given the taxes back to the school district with the intent that the school district give it back to those particular charter schools. So, you know, I did want to say that even though there are good relationships, certainly those can change from time to time, and I think that's what we as lawmakers look at, is how to keep those good relationships and how to keep that into law. So as much as I appreciate what the Mat-Su Borough is doing for their charter schools, it's certainly not in statute, and I think that's what I wanted to go on record. I have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very aware of the rail belt. Or I shouldn't say the rail belt, because that would include the Mat-Su, but the Anchorage legislators are very aware of the city of Anchorage complaining every time we have do something that they lose property taxes on. So I think it's great that Mat-Su does it. I think you'll have a harder time doing it in the Anchorage area, but I guess...
We shall see. Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of covered what I was wondering about, because if a municipality was not matching to the cap, it would seem that since those are public schools, they could just forego the taxes on those charter schools. And so, however that's done, I'm glad to see that Mat-Su is accomplishing that. I think that there would be a problem if they were already funding to the cap. So in a district that was funding to the cap, and then it would try to do more if they actually passed back money, whereas they might be able to forego taxes and not exceed the cap. So, but I appreciate what they're doing.
Thanks. Right, and it's a good comment, although it leads me to think, and I'm thinking of the Anchorage School District, and if I heard Aquarian Charter School correctly, taxing to the cap, asking their charter schools to pay the property tax and not refunding them back that portion, and not giving the charter schools equity with the neighborhood schools in regards to their municipal portion. So that's an interesting dichotomy.
And Madam Chair, I think the interesting thing is this is a municipality decision. So the municipality, if they pass an ordinance that allows them to not tax a public school facility, then that would mean that it wouldn't go through the school district. It would be a tax change that the municipality would make. So anyway, Madam Chair, appreciate it.
You bet. Representative Reinbold.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Gaddis. Basically, what I'm just reading in the statutes here, I'm trying to, we've had so much discussion about repurposing buildings, and in Section 1408.101, powers of a regional school board, it says establish, maintain, operate, discontinue, and combine schools subject to the approval of the commissioner. So it certainly seems like there's plenty of power in here, and so the commissioner should be involved in these discussions.
Thank you. Representative Quito.
I mean, I think more of a comment for me, I was just thinking about the property tax issue, and it seems to me that when you pay rent or a lease, that the property tax would be included, so I guess I'm a little surprised that a property tax bill is separate from the lease payments. So I don't completely understand that, and I guess one of the other comments I would make is it seems as though a lease or a rent payment for a building is based on market rates, so that if we do allow those property taxes to be exempted, then since that's a private entity leasing a facility, it would be in a sense a tax break for those individuals. Would the rent or the lease payments then go down, or are they required to keep them separate? It sounds like they're being billed separately. So.
Thank you. And for the record, I did just get some clarification on what the Mat-Su Borough does and what the Mat-Su School District does. And the Mat-Su Borough has allowed the Mat-Su School District to give the money back, but they have not necessarily set the money aside to give to the school district. School district wanted to go on record stating that they do help their charter schools and give that money back. They give that money. It's not necessarily given to them, if that makes any sense. So thank you, Mat-Su, for correcting me. And do we have any other questions or statements before we want to go on with Mrs. Gerard? With that, Barbara, please continue.
All right. After speaking about facilities, which is a continued issue, the last piece I wanted to speak about is maintenance. We operate as a charter school knowing that we're really one catastrophic event away from closing our doors. When, as an example, when Sioux Valley School burned, they weren't expected to rebuild their school out of an operating budget. So we would like to see some type of per pupil maintenance funding come in to put in type into some type of savings account to help rescue charter schools so that we do not have to, during a catastrophic event, go into our operation budget or actually go out of business. Because of the cost that we might have to be able to survive. So and then I'm going to move on. I wanted to speak about special education. As charter schools in the Mat-Su, we use a lottery to have our students selected. And with that, any student within the Mat-Su is able to attend our schools. A piece of that is that we have students that have active IEPs. For example, Fronteras, which is a Spanish immersion school, has 11 IEPs and hires one full-time resource teacher and has one itinerant school or speech pathologist. Academy Charter School has 26 active IEPs. They include students with ILD labels, other health impaired, emotionally disturbed labels, and children on the autism spectrum. And we hire a 0.65 special education resource teacher, and then we ability group our students, so all students are working at their skill level, and we're able to keep our class sizes down to about 14 in a classroom. But we sacrifice. We do not hire a nurse, nor do we have a day custodian in order to be able to do those things. American Charter School has 15 active IEPs for children with learning disabilities. Their facility constraints limit their ability to serve or successfully serve all students and just due to high ceilings and the situation in their lease facility. Midnight Sun has 16 active IEPs and 5 additional speech. They are only able to hire a half-time special education teacher and a half-time special education aide they really would like to hire a full-time special education teacher, but they just can't afford it with their lease costs. Birch Tree, who is a Waldorf, uses the Waldorf philosophy and approach, has 30 IEPs. Four of those meet the intensive funding criteria, and they hire a full-time and a half-time resource teacher. And my saying these or stating these, it's we just want everyone to understand that we serve all students, and we work hard to make sure that every student that comes through our doors receives the education that is going to best meet their needs. And then lastly, I'd like to see, or if we could offer some suggestions, we'd like to see the conversion charter schools options and maybe some type of incentive that would help traditional schools be able to turn into charter schools if the 65% of their staff wanted to do that. The process alone in creating something improves opportunities for innovation. Sometimes our own limitations force us to remain status quo. And whether those limitations are imagined or real, they do hold us up from, sometimes even greater innovations that we could be doing. The charter school allows us, or that process allows us to foster an environment and atmosphere where thought and the opportunity to dream and embrace new ideas, methods, and strategies to improve student learning and achievement. So we'd like to see all schools have some of those additional opportunities, and that's been expressed to me by various teachers within the district as well as other principals. And I do want to say that MATSU has been wonderful as far as the administration and to provide support and encouragement for our charter schools in this district. Something else we'd like to see would be the full funding where all monies, excuse me, I'm getting a cold, all monies that the students generate are passed through to the charter schools. And I did want to mention that Academy Charter School has worked with the school district to have two buses pick up at a centralized location. One picks up over in Wasilla, one picks up at our Four Corners area, and that way parents don't have to transport as far. And those buses then come to Academy Charter School both in the morning and in the evening and help transport kids to and from. The other piece, again, I'd just like to request that indirect cost percentage would be set and would not fluctuate. So it would be a fair and equitable percentage. And we've seen as high as 6.96% all the way down to 0.5%. So we feel like 3% would be fair and equitable. There's often a question about what that indirect fee is purchasing. And possibly we should look at some type of itemizing those what services are included within that. And then the last piece, any legislative directive or direct appropriation grant should have an attached requirement that the pass-through government entity, such as the borough, could only retain 2.5% for their overhead and indirect costs. For example, the MATSU Borough took 5% from the direct appropriation grant for academies' classrooms, and that's a big chunk. And that could have gone into building classroom space. Those are my main comments. We just appreciate all of your hard work, and we encourage you to quickly move this bill forward and so that it makes it through on this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And we're going to move it as quick as we can, but I don't know if quickly is going to be how. And I anticipated that the charter school part would probably be the most cumbersome in this bill because there are a lot of things that folks don't understand about charter schools. And quite frankly, sitting here hearing these presentations, I even learned a lot. I thank you for what I think putting to rest the myth that special ed students are not covered in charter schools and don't allow them. I think that folks tried to understand how that happened, and because it's a new way of happening, and many of us may not have grown up in charter schools or even in the charter school time period, it's a struggle to try to catch up. So I really appreciate your comments and trying to catch us up. We do have a couple questions. And Representative Seaton.
Thank you. When we were talking to Quarry and they were saying that the federal dollars for military personnel, they were looking for the percentage allocation for those military students that are in the charter schools, not a per student basis. Would you, with the great disparity of numbers of special ed kids in different charter schools, would you also think that the same kind of rationale being the relation, the proportion of those students that are in particular schools be used, or are you looking at a per student across the entire district-wide analysis?
Through the chair and representative, MATSU is unique in that they are really working purposely to be able to make sure the money follows the child. And it's my understanding that, for example, Birchtree, with their four intensive students or students that are labeled intensive, they receive the increased funding that would be on a per pupil amount for an intensive student. And I have the printout that I would be glad to send to you. That was provided to us by Luke Fulp, our business director, which really breaks down the ADM, cost for all of our students, and it's very clear, and I'd be glad to send that.
And please do, Barbara, if you'll send it to my office, I'll make sure that everybody gets a copy. Thank you. I have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, a lot of the charter schools, and I don't know which ones, but many of the children all have IEPs. Does that happen in any of the schools? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, our school has what we call individualized learning plans for every child. But as far as an active IEP for every child, I have not heard of that.
Okay, so there's a difference then. They're not called IEPs, they're called ILPs.
Yes.
So any special ed child that would normally get an IEP in a regular school, only the same child would get one in a charter school?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, I believe that's correct. That we follow under the same criteria for a child to meet special education requirements.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We do have one person in the audience. I have nobody signed up online and we didn't notice folks to testify. I always like to acknowledge those that have flown so far. And if we could have Jack Walsh, if he's still in the audience and would like to testify, we appreciate you coming to the Capitol. And thank you for speaking. We are about 5 or 6 minutes over, but we do appreciate you coming. If you'll introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, I'm Jack Walsh. I'm the superintendent in the Craig School District, and I appreciate the opportunity to sit here with the Education Committee. I just wanted to make a couple points, so I'll try to be fairly brief. The idea of charter schools and the choice that's involved in that involves, as you know, the deputy commissioner said, 8 or 9 districts and possibly 13 communities. And so it's unique that it doesn't reach out across the state, and it doesn't necessarily impact many of our rural districts and many other parts of our state. The question that came up earlier when there was comments being made about teacher selection and the teacher's choice about moving to a charter school or not, I think, you know, again, it was all done with some really good intentions, that the state's plan was sometimes when charter schools were being formed, some community members were concerned that the teachers that would be sent over there to work with those schools wouldn't be necessarily the teachers that the parents would choose, and that the school was set up to serve. Another concern was, as an example, when you've mentioned several times a Spanish immersion school, if I was told that would be my new assignment, I wouldn't be very useful there. My 4 years of high school Spanish would never really qualify me to serve those children well. So there's things about native languages and other kind of foreign languages, which some of our charter schools are about, that not every teacher could go in there and be successful.
And Mr. Walsh, if you don't mind, that's one of the I totally agree with you that the unfortunate part is in the bargaining unit. If that's the next teacher looking for a job and that's the only place for them, even if, and if we'll use a Spanish immersion school, and I happen to know that this has happened, that maybe somebody with their first language isn't even English, let alone Spanish, is now in that Spanish immersion school. So you may not wish to, but in order to keep a job and the way the union, the bargaining unit has determined, I mean, it beats nothing, and you are forced as a charter school, a Spanish immersion charter school, to take that teacher. And it's just an interesting concept. So I think my bigger challenge was the charter school teacher has to consent to want to going there to the charter school, but they don't necessarily have to that same consent going to a specific neighborhood school. And I just saw the difference there. Mm-hmm. And that's what I spoke to, and I appreciate you coming forward and talking about that. So please continue.
No, and I appreciate, because I think what the department represented today is, again, that often for these charter schools to work and teacher assignments to work and everything, they have to sit with their bargaining unit and suggest that there have to be some changes to allow that flexibility. So, you know, the other piece, and this will be the last one to make, I hear a lot about the transportation issue. And my understanding is of the districts that offer charter schools, that may be an issue in one district, not necessarily all, that I think most are doing a really good job of trying to provide and support schools in that way. So that's what I wanted to say, and I sure appreciate your time.
And we do have a couple of questions. Representative Quito.
I just wanted to make a comment. Thank you, Jack. Great to see you again, and thanks for your comments.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other folks that want to put him on the hot seat? And we do appreciate you stepping forward. Representative Ledoux.
I just wanted to say hello to Jack, because we've known each other forever, because Jack started out in Kodiak, didn't you?
That was one of my first stops in the state. So, thank you.
Any other questions? And with that, thank you very much. We will have our next meeting. We'll be on Wednesday. And I wish to say that we would wrap up the charter school aspect, but I'm not going to be that. We'll certainly continue on with the charter school aspect. And with that, this meeting is adjourned until Wednesday.